and I jumped. I looked back toward Lucy, but if she had heard the noise, she did not betray it. She remained still, implacable, staring at the lion at the empty fire grate.
"What happened?" I asked.
"He was hit by a car," she replied. "No one knows exactly how he got out, but suddenly he was off, running toward the main street."
She paused.
"The impact should have killed him instantly, but it didn't."
I shuddered, imagining the injured dog, suspended somewhere between life and death, imagining the pain. "Didn't you take him somewhere? For help, I mean?"
My voice, I knew, was pleading, but in that moment, standing in the cold, drafty mansion, I felt suddenly that I needed nothing so much as for Lucy to tell me that they had, that yes, the dog had been saved, that it had lived, that it was still living, and that everything was fine. I knew, of course, that she wouldn't.
"My mother couldn't drive," she said.
"But what about the neighbors? Wasn't there someone you could call?"
I felt frantic then, wanting to shake her, to wreck that stoic attitude, her shield and protection, I had already begun to suspect, from everyone around her. If nothing else, I wanted her to tell me that she had done everything that she could, that she had tried to save the life of this improbable dog that was never meant to be hers, that she had loved him fiercely enough for that. Finally, she turned her face to mine, her black eyes searching. She smiled, a strange, unnerving expression that sent my heart stammering, anxious to be away from her, from this place. She opened her mouth.
"There was no one."
I exhaled, slowly.
"So what did you do?"
"We sat and waited for him to die."
She stopped, seeming to weigh her next words.
"And he did, eventually. But it was slow, and he was in terrible pain. And so my mother went out into the garden and found a rock. It would be quicker, she said, and kinder. And because he was mine, it was my responsibility, and no one else's."
She shook her head, turning away.
"It was horrible, Alice," she concluded, her tone steely and hard.
I did not believe her. Raising my hand to my mouth, in shock, in doubt, I didn't know, I could not help but be struck by the thought that the story, her story, I reminded myself, had seemed strangely distant, as if it had happened to another person entirely. Her words had been slow and measured. She hadn't paused to catch her breath, to wipe away the tears from her eyes. It was as if the story had been cauterized, so that it no longer belonged to her at all, so that I did not believe her when she said it was horrible, did not believe her about any of it. I thought of the way that she had spoken of her parents, of that detached expression I had envied. In that moment, it was no longer something that I was as eager to covet. I stepped backward.
"Let's go, Lucy."
Her eyes seemed to flash at the sound of her name, as if remembering where she was and who she was with, as if everything that had come before had been spoken in some sort of trance, and only then had she awakened from it.
"Not yet," she said, reaching for my hand. "There's one more thing I want to show you."
Ignoring my protests, she turned us to the grand staircase, moving quickly so that I had to increase my pace to keep up with her.
"Hurry,"
she called back, as if reading my thoughts. We continued to race upward until my breath came in short, ragged gasps, and my lungs began to burn.
"Lucy,"
I panted, knowing that I would soon be unable to match her in speed.
"Just a little farther,"
she promised, not bothering to look back, still firmly holding my hand. When she stopped, so abruptly that I nearly crashed into her, we stood in front of a window, wide and curved in a half-circle. From our new vantage point, I could see that she had led us up to the mansion's top floor. Lucy moved her face closer to the window, her fingertips splayed out on either side of her, pressed firmly into the glass.
"The other girls say it's haunted, that a family died here," she whispered. I frowned.
"What family?"
"The Jennings, the ones who first owned the house. They say the wife killed herself, that she threw herself out of this window just here. And then the husband, out of grief, hung himself from one of the trees.
That doesn't sound true, I replied, though I whispered the words. I heard that the family donated this building to the college.
Lucy ignored my question. There was a student, too, a few years ago. She threw herself from this same window, just like Mrs. Jennings.
I turned to look out the window, at the imprints of her fingertips, their individual etchings pressed against the glass. I thought of the stories of the women who had supposedly ended their lives here, one generation after another. And then all at once I felt it, something watching me from somewhere within the dark recesses of the house. I turned to the left and then to the right, knowing that I had seen something just out of reach of my vision. I thought at first that it might have been Lucy, but then I realized that she was gone. I was standing by the window alone, empty hallways stretching on either side of me, a half dozen or so doorways down each corridor. I thought of the shadows, certain they were there, somewhere, lying in wait, so that I had the urge to fling open each and every door in order to prove there was nothing behind them. And then I remembered about what Lucy had told me only moments before, how her parents died when she was 5 years old. I frowned. It didn't make her story impossible. Perhaps she truly did remember that horrible story from so young an age. And yet, what, I asked myself, what was it that had bothered me? I thought again of her detached manner, as if she were reciting a story that she had heard from someone else. I shook my head, feeling another breeze, a draft, I supposed, as it moved through the building. There was no reason for her to lie. I heard something in the distance again, and my heart began to race. I could feel the familiarity of it, beginning in my fingertips. A nervous condition, the doctors had said, most likely brought on by the stress of my parents' death. It was a pressure, a grip, one that felt as though it would strangle me, for surely it possessed enough strength, enough power. Part of me had imagined, naively I realized, that leaving England behind might mean leaving that all behind as well, that distance was all that was needed to dispel the ghosts of my past. I had been a fool, I thought, angry at myself, at my ignorance. It would follow me, always, no matter where or how far I went. But then, standing just a few paces away on the staircase, so that I towered over her and not the other way around, stood Lucy. She watched me with those strange, inquisitive eyes, and then she smiled and said, "There's nothing to be afraid of, Alice." Her voice was so certain, so sure. Lucy extended her hand toward me. "Come on, let's go get supper." All at once I felt the darkness that had threatened me only a second before begin to lift, until it no longer felt like I was some gothic heroine trapped in a haunted castle, a patriarchal labyrinth that was impossible to ever escape. Instead, I was simply Alice, and she was Lucy. And there was nothing to be afraid of any longer. I felt her hand searching for mine, her fingers interlacing with my own. I grasped it, and together we fled the darkened mansion, leaving behind all the ghosts it held within, both real and imagined. There was a commotion outside the bar, and then something louder, an explosion of sorts which brought me hurtling back to the present. I thought at first it was gunfire, thought I could feel the hot bite of it against my skin. I thought of the riots, of the violence that had been erupting throughout Morocco, that had touched Tangier only recently, proving that even she was not immune. John had spoken of it only briefly, making it sound as though it had been amusing that day when the locals had decided to take to the streets, hurtling bottles at the foreign-owned stores, and later, when the police responded with gunfire, anything they could use to defend themselves. And when news came out that several lives had been claimed in the skirmish, and almost all of them locals, John had only shrugged, had told me it was nothing to worry about, that these minor rebellions would be squashed eventually. His faith had been absolute.
It seemed that not even he, with his professed love for Tangier, had been able to foresee the determination of its people to reclaim their independence, to reclaim their Tangier, had refused to acknowledge, to recognize just how important, how absolutely necessary it was to their life, to their survival. I turned to look over my shoulder and saw a flash of lights just beyond the din of the bar. No one was shouting or running away. There was only laughter and the sounds of celebration. Fireworks, then, I noted. Locals celebrating their approaching independence. The idea caused something to prickle just there at the back of my mind. I moved and knocked over the glass in front of me, sending it onto the ground, splintering into sharp, nearly invisible pieces, the gin and tonic soaking my dress. Letting out a sharp exclamation, I stood quickly, the suddenness of my movement causing the dog beneath the table to let out a yelp of dismay, scrambling from his safe hold. Though not before his teeth found purchase, my unexpected movement causing him to sink his teeth into my leg. I looked down to see a trail of blood slipping down my now tattered stocking. The sight made me strangely dizzy. "He didn't mean it," I whispered to no one, watching as the dog disappeared from the bar. My head still felt light as I moved to help pick up the broken glass, the bartender now heading toward the mess that I had made, and I felt myself blush with embarrassment. I thought then of John and his angry scowl that evening, of Lucy and her penetrating gaze, always looking, always searching, I worried, for something that was not there. And then I thought I saw him, John, at the bar, though he wasn't alone, wasn't with Charlie, as he'd promised. And there was Lucy, just behind him, watching, watching, watching. And then I felt the hard, sticky floor of the bar beneath me as I fainted, falling slowly at first, and then faster, without anyone at all to catch me.
Chapter 4 Lucy. I found the souks electrifying, the labyrinthine curve of them, dark and packed, with vendors that stood behind stalls or sat on the floor, the bags and buckets of wares splayed out before them. At first, I had been nearly swept up in its fast-moving current, but then I had slowed my gait, walking steadily with purpose. I stopped at one stall and then another, purchasing a few grams of bright green olives at one, a stack of hot, sweating misimin at another. I inspected the hanging carcasses of chickens, not recoiling at the smell the way most tourists I observed did, but considering and haggling, as if I intended to purchase one. I paused in front of the brightly dressed riff women, opting for a handful of broad beans instead, and then a wheel of white cheese, the kind I had seen locals eat, the sides covered with intricately braided green leaves. I had given up on my day dresses, although it appeared that there were a number of expat women who still favored them. I found the fitted bodice too restrictive in the heat, and the skirt prone to catching against the jagged edges of the city. Instead, I had liberated several pairs of capris from my suitcase, ones that I had not yet mustered the courage to wear back home, and a couple of monochrome blouses that seemed more prepared to handle the climate. I had tried to convince Alice to come, but she had refused. Shaking her head, waving her hands around the cluttered apartment to indicate all the work she should do before John arrived home, work that never seemed to be completed, but that went on and on. "Go," she had said. "Enjoy your holiday." I had frowned and pleaded, but it soon became apparent that she did not intend to give in. The vehemence with which she shook her head when I had pressed the issue, the thin white of her lips as she moved them together, gave the impression that her reluctance to show a friend around the city was something much more serious than just her need to attend to the laundry. I thought of her as I walked. Alice, her lovely, lily-white skin, that had obviously not seen sun for quite some time, locked up within the walls of their flat. I remembered the paleness of her face from the night before, after that wretched beast had bitten her, after she had fainted and fallen onto the ground. She had grown quiet, quieter still. As we had been forced to find a doctor in the hours afterward, a frantic search for a vaccination and a check for any possible concussion. And in the ensuing chaos, I had been forced to push aside what I had seen, what I had witnessed in the moments before Alice had been bitten. It had happened shortly after John disappeared from the table. I had looked up, away from Alice, away from my drink, and into the mirror fastened on the wall before me. I had seen him, his image distorted by the divots in the glass, standing at the bar. Only he had not been alone, had not been with anyone named Charlie. Instead, a woman stood beside him, her face half obscured by a mane of long dark hair. A local, I thought, watching as his fingers trailed the upper part of her thigh, pushing at the material of her dress. I had glanced at Alice, but it didn't seem like she had noticed, and I cast a hurried glance back to the mirror, appraising the angle at which it hung, uncertain whether she would be able to see them at all, even if she did look up. Part of me wanted to show her, to point out the reflection, the truth displayed brazenly before us. But something stayed me. Something whispered that it was not the time, that I should wait before revealing this bit of information to her. This girl I had once known as well as myself, and who looked at me now with an expression I couldn't quite understand, couldn't quite manage to breach. I wound my way through the Medina and over to the Grand Soko, where a pleasant sort of plaza greeted me. Green spaces filled with flowers, couples, groups of men and expat pensioners enjoying a leisurely stroll in the afternoon heat, and several feet away, a large imposing building that towered over the rest. Cinema Riff, the sign read, its facade dim and grimy. What had once no doubt consisted of brilliant reds, blues, and yellows had faded under the thick application of dust that had since settled. Housed within the cinema was a small cafe, a scattering of chairs arranged just inside the building, the doors thrown open to the sun, with a few leftover tables and chairs scattered on the sidewalk outside. I moved quickly to take a seat. A small round table intended for two pushed up against the building's rough wall, underneath a poster advertisement for a French film I had never heard of before that pictured a young boy standing beneath a red balloon. Several moments passed before the waitress appeared, a short, squat woman whose face was lined with wrinkles. I was relieved to find she spoke French, and although I knew only a few scattering of words, it was enough to successfully place an order, as within minutes she returned, a tall glass filled with hot Moroccan mint tea clutched between her fingers. Her severe face broke into a grin as she placed it in front of me. "Merci," I murmured, moving to adjust the glass. I instantly recoiled, hissing with surprise. I glanced down at my fingers, the tips of which had turned a bright pink. "Attention," the woman laughed. "Il est chaud." I blushed. "Oui, merci." While all of the guidebooks had extolled the virtues of drinking mint tea in Morocco, they had failed to advise on just how treacherous the endeavor could be. I was used to the thick porcelain of New England diners, not thin glass that seemed to threaten to melt one's fingers. There were no handles. And I wondered how on earth one was supposed to drink the concoction.
"Lentement, mademoiselle."
I looked over my shoulder to see who had spoken.
"Slowly. You must have patience."
He was standing at the opening of the cafe, neither inside nor outside, and without food or drink in hand, leaning with confidence against the wall of the building. I could see right away that it was the same man from the day before, the one who had been watching me in the Medina. I smiled, but turned back, hesitant to be drawn into conversation with him. To the left of where he stood, a shoe shiner was busy at work, moving swiftly between his client's right and left foot, though his own shoes, I noticed, appeared to be placed on backward. After a few moments of closer inspection, I could see that the man appeared to be missing his feet altogether, and that he had placed the shoes backward upon the stumps of his legs only in order to steady himself. I continued to watch him work, falling into a near trance-like state as he first applied Shiner, and then, withdrawing a rag from his belt, began to swipe with long, vigorous strokes, repeating this movement with sustained intensity before moving on to the next shoe. I took a sip of my mint tea, no longer scalding, and felt the rush of the syrup as the sweetness exploded on my tongue. The man was still watching. I could feel his eyes boring, examining, trying to pick me apart from across the way. There was a shift then, a change in the air, so that it seemed rife. With danger, with possibility, though I didn't yet know which. And so I waited, breath held in expectation, already wondering whether I wanted him to leave me in peace, or whether I would be disappointed if he did.
"I'm Joseph,"
he said, the decision made, moving toward me and extending his hand. He did not wear the traditional jalaba, I noted, though he was most certainly Moroccan. Instead, he wore a pair of charcoal-gray trousers, a light button-up shirt that was rolled to the elbows, a thin scarf was thrown across his neck, and a tan fedora hat, adorned with a purple ribbon once again, and which I suspected bore the stains of being worn in such unforgiving heat, sat on his head tilted to the left. There was something dapper about his outfit, despite its thriftiness, or perhaps it was the way he wore it, with a jauntiness that was out of place among the other Moroccan men I had observed, and who appeared in comparison solemn and grave. I hesitated at his introduction, only for a second, and then the words slipped from my mouth easily, as though it were true. "Alice."
"Welcome to Tangier, mademoiselle."
He paused.
"And where are you staying during your holiday, Alice?"
He said the name so that the last part came out sounding like a hiss. "Alice." He asked the question, his eyes averted, staring down and back into the Medina. His tone was casual, deliberately so, as if he had rehearsed the question before it was asked. "With friends?" I replied, trying to make my voice sound light, effortless, as though I was used to answering such questions from strangers, as though my life were spent moving from one place to the next, from Paris to Cairo and on to the Orient. I let the idea settle, the one that Alice and I had given birth to so many years ago now, and that remained trapped just beneath the surface, simmering, it seemed, waiting to be released. There were times when I could feel it, the desperation of wanting to watch the sun set over the pyramids, wanting to taste the salty egg and sweet cardamom noodles of Arabia, wanting to be anywhere and everywhere but the depressing tiny shared bedroom of a boarding house, and knowing that it was impossible.
"And you are not afraid to explore the city on your own?"
he questioned. I peered up at him, wondering what it was that he intended. "Should I be?" I asked. He gave an exaggerated shrug.
"Only last year we had a madman running around the city with a butcher's knife."
I eyed the streets in front of us, assessing. "And was anyone injured?"
"Yes, of course,"
he answered easily.
"The man killed 5 people and injured nearly 6 more."
He must have seen the hard look that I affixed on my face, for his expression lost some of its seriousness, and he broke into a large grin, one that I found somehow more disconcerting than his formerly somber mask.
"Relax,"
he advised, pausing to bring a cigarette to his lips.
"I was only teasing Miss Alice."
I let out a breath I hadn't realized I was holding, wondering still at the motivation behind his words. "So that didn't happen?" His smile disappeared.
"Oh no, it most definitely happened. The man was shot in the stomach before he was taken to Malabata prison, but you are quite safe here. That is the part I was teasing about. There is nothing to worry about now, Miss Alice,"
he assured me.
"Where are you from?"
"Chicago," I lied.
"Chicago?"
he exclaimed, frowning.
"This is the most dangerous place of them all. I have a cousin who went to Chicago, He was very horrible, he said. Too many murders. You do not have to worry about such things here.
He paused.
But if you are looking for a place that makes sense, I feel I must provide this warning. You will be disappointed.
He let out a small laugh.
This is Africa, after all.
He grinned, his smile stretching across his gaunt, tanned face.
Many forget that. They think we are somewhere different entirely. This might be true, but it is also false. Tangier is still Africa. One need only consult a map to know this.
He turned back toward me, eyes boring into my own.
And where do your friends live?
In a flat? I replied. He smiled thinly.
Yes, but where is this flat?
I searched for an answer, unsure whether I wanted to part with such information. There was something about him that whispered he was harmless, another mosquito that could easily be flicked away. But still, the answer hung heavily on my tongue. I was not afraid of him, or afraid for my safety. Men like him, I knew, were not the ones to fear. I was simply unsure of what I had to offer him, of what he could offer me, of the potential usefulness that we might offer one another. Beyond the Medina, somewhere? I finally answered. I'm afraid I can't offer any more specifics. I've only just arrived and I'm not too familiar with the city yet. Lies, we both knew. I could tell by the glint in his eye, the slight curve of his lip. The only question was how he would react to it. He tilted his head from side to side, as if weighing my answer, my betrayal.
This is good,
he finally observed.
It is better to be in a flat than a hotel. Unless you are only staying for a few days, then a hotel is always best.
He looked at me, waiting for a response. I'm staying for quite some time, I hope. He nodded, apparently pleased.
So you are a tourist?
I nodded. Yes, I suppose I am.
Not a traveler, then?
He laughed. I puzzled over the difference in words between tourist and traveler. I had never really been many places, had never really seen much, so I supposed myself a tourist rather than a traveler. But there was something in the way he had pronounced the words, a disdain for the former that suggested it was the latter that I should strive for, whether or not it was true. I began to place my coins on the table, my tea now empty. Is there a distinction?
Yes, of course.
I could see then instantly that I'd said the wrong thing, but that this was also what he wanted, to be able to shake his head and laugh at the naivete of the young American woman in front of him. To lean in with a conspirator's grin, beckoning me to come closer, closer, and closer still.
You are unfamiliar with Bowles, I see. You must read him, if you wish to understand this place,
he instructed. Is he Moroccan? I asked, unfamiliar with the name. He laughed.
He is not Moroccan, no, but he spends a good deal of time here. We see one another often and wave. He is a familiar, a neighbor, not simply a famous writer.
Bowles. I placed the name somewhere in my mind, making a mental note to check whether John had any of his works scattered among the unread books that lined the flat. For while I considered myself something of an expert in classical literature, particularly anything British, I was the first to admit my deficiencies in more contemporary work, as it had never managed to hold my attention in the same manner. Give me the wilds of an English moor, or the gritty urban streets of Victorian London, and I would feel, if nothing else, at home. But as to the latest stream of authors sweeping the country, I was essentially a novice. Perhaps this is what the man offered, a guide to the country that Alice now called home, however reluctantly. Perhaps there was worth to be found there, I thought. I promise to read him the very first chance I have, I said.
Good. Then you will learn the difference between a tourist and a traveler, and we shall see which one you are.
He leaned over, offering a cigarette.
Here.
I paused, Alice did not smoke. The distinction seemed important to uphold, and so I shook my head demurely. He shrugged and pulled an expression as if to indicate it was my loss. And I did regret my decision. Almost instantly, I inhaled the fragrant smoke, heavy and perfume-like. French, most likely. Galois. One didn't smell many of them around Tangier, I had already noticed. I wondered if I could change my mind, but then that would reveal a part of me to the stranger that I wasn't yet sure I could trust. Better to remain behind the veneer a bit longer.
I have a studio by the ocean where I paint, he said,
after a few moments' consideration.
This is where you must come.
By the ocean? I repeated. After several days in Tangier, despite the fact that it was a port city, I had seen very little of the water. It was strange, I thought, the way the city was able to swallow you up so completely.
Yes, it is next to Café Haffa. Do you know it?
I shook my head.
Ah, he exclaimed, this is the place you must go. It is where all the artists are. They also have the best mint tea, he said, gesturing to my empty glass. And the view? It is much better than this. Just the ocean. Nothing else.
It sounds beautiful.
It is.
He smiled, nodding his head. He peered at me through the smoke.
So, Miss Alice, tell me, do you want to see the real Tangier?
I hesitated, assuming he meant to offer himself as a guide, and wondering at the same time at the advisability of such an idea. Disappearing into a city I knew little about, with a man about whom I knew even less. But then I thought of Alice, stagnated by fear, stuck inside the dark confines of her flat, day after day, waiting for John to return from work. Waiting. Both of us, always waiting. I shook my head, as if to shake the word from my mind, as if I could somehow physically dislodge it from my vocabulary. I had spent a good deal of my life waiting. Too much time. I nodded, a sharp, pointed gesture that conveyed my acceptance of his offer.
Morocco is your home.
He said the words slowly, watching my face closely as he spoke.
Yes, it is yours. You are a tangerine now.
He pronounced it tangerine, like the fruit. I smiled, letting the thought settle. Morocco was mine. And it could be, I reasoned. After all, what did I have to return to? A damp, shared room on the wrong side of New York? Endless days spent typing up other writers' manuscripts. Here, I could finally write something of my own. Put pen to paper as I had always dreamed of during college, as Alice and I had dreamed together. And if that meant making Morocco my own, I was prepared to do just that. I was a tangerine now, after all.
Chapter 5 Alice. I did not ask her where she had spent her day, or whom she had spent it with. I did not ask what she was doing in Tangier, why she was here, what she wanted, still too afraid of the answers I might receive. Instead, I smiled, the gesture feeling odd and forced, and told her to sit, told her I would make drinks again, the nights already beginning to take on the shape of those we had spent at Bennington. I wondered at the ease of it, of how quickly we had slipped back into our roles, how comfortable already it had begun to feel. And I resented it, the feeling that I had tried to clasp onto at the bar suddenly mine, strong and fierce, until I could think of nothing else but the way that she had so carefully reinserted herself back into my life, without a mention of the past, of her part in what had unfolded between us, the tragedy that had ensconced us. I didn't know what I expected her to say, not exactly, but there was neither a word nor a glance, not anything at all that seemed to indicate she recalled those last few weeks we had spent together, and the tension that had grown between us. I could feel my anger growing, and I forced myself to concentrate on the task at hand, peeling the zest from the lemon that I had bought at the market 2 weeks past, the skin of the fruit now dried, withered.
I called from the kitchen. It's like this most nights, I'm afraid. John is always off to one dinner party or another.
And what about you? Don't you ever go with him?
She called back. No, not anymore. I thought of the faces I had been introduced to those first few months, appraising and cold. I did at first, but, well, it turned out they weren't for me. Tangier seems to attract a certain type, and I'm afraid that I don't generally fit the description. I found her perched beside the window, gazing out. At my entrance she turned, frowning. Do you like it at all, Alice? Tangier, I mean? My face burned a fiercer shade of red. Oh, I don't know. I suppose I haven't really given it a chance. Or at least that's what John always says. I did not add that I often doubted whether there was any truth in what John said. Wondered instead whether the truth wasn't something much simpler. Tangier and I were not suited for one another. That we never would be, no matter how many chances I gave it. From the little I knew of it already, I had realized what a hard place it could be. It was not a place where one simply arrived and belonged. No, I imagined that it was a process, a trial, even an initiation of sorts, one that only the bravest survived. It was a place that inspired rebellion, a place that demanded it, of its people, its citizens, a place where everyone had to constantly adapt, struggle, fight for what they wanted. I looked up at the woman in front of me. It was a place for someone like Lucy.
I made a friend today, Lucy said, bringing me back to the present. A Moroccan man. Rather strange, I suppose, though he was quite kind. I was sitting outside of Cinema Riff. Do you know it?
When I nodded, she continued.
I was having a tea, and he happened to notice I was sitting there alone. He offered to show me around Tangier, in fact. He mentioned something about being an artist. A painter, I think.
I felt myself flush at her words, felt it spread throughout my body. My dress, despite the pink blush fabric, was severe and unyielding in the evening heat. There was something strangely unsettling about Lucy's piece of information, about the fact that she had already made an acquaintance, a friend, and suddenly I could feel it. A tinge of envy, of jealousy, growing hot in the pit of my stomach. I could feel a sheen of sweat break across my forehead. Here, I said, handing her the drink I still held, clutched between my fingers. I moved toward the sofa, hoping she would follow, that she would forget what it was that she had just been discussing. Try this, I instructed, worried as she sat down beside me that she would feel it, the heat that now seemed to radiate from my body.
What is it? She asked, shifting closer.
Just my own creation. I let out a nervous laugh, raising the glass to meet my lips. It helps to pass the time. She took a cautious sip, and I knew what she was tasting. A sweetness, like cherries. That's the grenadine, I said. There's a brand that I love in France. I make sure John always brings back a bottle or two whenever he travels to the continent.
And you? Do you go home often? She asked, peering at me over her drink.
To England? I shook my head, trying not to think of it, of the smell that was London, fragrant and stale, rich and musty. I pushed it aside, and in its absence something else occurred to me, in the silence of the room. That sounds like Yusuf, I said. She frowned.
What does?
The man you were just describing. I was wondering if it might be Yusuf.
Joseph, you mean?
I shook my head. No, Yusuf. He's notorious for preying on unsuspecting tourists. Everyone here knows him, if not directly, well, at least about him.
Perhaps this was someone different,
she ventured, her voice sharper than it had been a moment before. I could see that the information had unnerved her, that the idea that she might somehow have been taken in sat poorly. It was, after all, something that I would have expected of myself. I trusted too easily, too often, I knew. And then there it was again,
That awful feeling, tinged with green, that stirred in my belly and made me strangely glad to see that it was Lucy who had done something wrong, that it was Lucy who had been taken in by another's kind word. I found myself unable to stop.
Fedora with a purple ribbon?
She frowned and nodded.
That's him, then. John says he lures tourists back to his house, then demands money for all sorts of useless junk. I think he once had a girl involved, pretending to be his daughter.
I shrugged.
The locals never say anything to the tourists. In fact, they find it all rather amusing, I'm afraid.
Before I could say anything more, the front door opened, and John's voice rang throughout the apartment.
I'm not home for good. I just need to grab a few things before heading back out. Ignore me.
I placed my palm to my cheek, willing the coldness of my hand to stop the flush that had spread across my face over the last few minutes, emboldened, it seemed, by Lucy's misstep.
I was just telling Lucy about Yusuf, I said, calling out,
recalling the litany of amusing stories that John had on the subject. I thought of the other night, of the spectacle John had made of himself, of us, and I wanted him to show her then what it was that I had seen in him, to prove that he was not altogether horrible, that I had not made a complete and utter mess of my life when I agreed to marry him in the tiny register's office that rainy summer day. John murmured something, but it was impossible to tell whether it was just an acknowledgement of having heard, or an indication of his interest, a prompt for me to continue. I paused briefly, my hands stilled in front of me, a smile frozen across my features.
You know, the man with the purple ribbon on his hat, I continued.
At this, John emerged, his face shiny with sweat. He moved to the bar, filling his glass with a generous serving of gin, followed by a small splash of tonic. I noted that he had not bothered to remove his hat.
I've told her to be careful, that he's a grafter of sorts, I continued.
A grifter, honey.
Yes, that, I said, flushing worse. I'm always mixing up words, I explained, turning back to Lucy. John is always having to correct me. I'm afraid I can't keep anything straight.
Lucy smiled, though it seemed tight, her demeanor, I had already noticed, shifting in John's presence. I turned away quickly.
Tell her,
I implored him. Begging, I could not help thinking, the way a child did a parent or a puppy their master.
About what you heard from your friends at work.
John nodded and turned back to the bar. He poured a second drink, neat, and only then did he commence his story.
It's typical in Tangier, you'll find. One of the guys at the office knew a couple, some young Americans on holiday, when they happened to run into Yusuf. They got to talking, thought he was harmless enough. In fact, they thought he might even be someone to know, or someone in the know, if you catch my meaning. They thought it might be beneficial to tag along with him, see where the night took them.
He paused, as if for dramatic effect.
Well, Yusuf led them back to what he said was his place, some out-of-the-way dive on the wrong side of the Casbah. The couple now has no idea where they are, only that they've been walking for quite some time and have lost all sense of direction. Then, before they know it, they're standing in front of a garbage heap of sorts. It's pitch black, and there's no one around except them and Yusuf. He asks for money, of course, demands they pay him in order to show them the way back to their hotel. Well, the Americans are outraged. They refuse flat out to pay him. They start walking around, trying to figure a way back into the Casbah, back into the Medina, but they can't. It's late, the wife is getting worried, so eventually they just give in and pay him. He takes them back, but only far enough so that they recognize their way, not to the hotel itself. The Americans say, fine, thank you, leave us alone now. They're happy to get on their way. They start walking, and then...
This is the best bit, I broke in, smiling.
John paused.
Alice, do you want to tell the story yourself?
He let out a short laugh, and attempting, it seemed, to lighten his tone, though his words were still short and clipped, said,
I don't know why you even bothered to call me in here. It doesn't seem as if you need my assistance.
No, no, I replied,
affecting something like a pout, though I did not mean to, and sinking back into the couch.
You tell it. It's always better when you do.
John let out an exaggerated sigh, as if to further demonstrate how unreasonable I was being, his silly little wife. I nearly expected him to turn toward Lucy with a shake of his head and a roll of his eyes, followed by a commiseration on the more irritating points of the Alice they had in common. Instead, he looked at neither of us, but began his tale once more, picking up where he had left off and diving into the story as though no interruption had ever occurred.
So they start walking, and about 15 minutes later, who should show up again but Yusuf? He's back for more money, and you'll never guess why.
The silence indicated that this was where Lucy and I, the captive audience members, were expected to join in.
Why?
I asked at Lucy's silence.
He says that they should pay him for agreeing to leave them alone.
John leaned back and laughed, the liquid in his cup moving dangerously from side to side.
Can you believe the nerve of the man? You have to give him credit, I suppose. He certainly is inventive.
Yes, I suppose so, Lucy replied, though her eyes were narrowed.
Why are you so curious about Yusuf, anyhow?
John glanced in my direction, a grin breaking across his face.
What? Did she happen to fall for one of his tricks?
He teased.
No, it's nothing like that,
I said, shooting Lucy a nervous glance.
I happened to mention that I met him today,
she said, trying, I could see, to dispel the coldness from her voice.
He seemed friendly enough,
she concluded.
Friendly?
John laughed.
Yes, well, what's wrong with that?
I demanded, embarrassed by John's cavalier attitude. I had only wanted a chance to change Lucy's mind, to show her that John wasn't entirely awful, that he could be good fun when he felt like it. Only it had all gone wrong again. John had been cruel, Lucy had been offended. There was nothing, I suspected then, that I would be able to do to convince the other that they were worth knowing. But then, of course, it shouldn't have surprised me. Not really. Lucy and I had always functioned as a twosome, held separate and apart from the rest. Distinct.
Honey, John said, shaking his head. Friendly is the grift.
I realized then, watching Lucy as she glared at John, as he in turn eyed her with something like distaste, derision, there was nothing to be done. Nothing at all. Everything had changed during our junior year at Bennington College. I had been away for the holidays, visiting my aunt on one of her trips to the East Coast. A formal dinner in whatever hotel she had been staying fast becoming our holiday ritual. And though she had offered to hire a driver to take me back to Bennington, I had insisted on catching the bus. I had left later that day, already looking forward to returning to my room, to Lucy, to what had fast become the definition of home. But as the bus pulled up at the station several hours later, I had felt my stomach drop. We were still in Massachusetts, had not yet crossed the border, and while I knew that my ticket included a connection to Vermont, looking out of the window, my nose pressed against the cold glass, I could see that the bus station was completely dark. "The bus will be here," the driver assured me when I questioned him. "But the station," I said, casting a nervous glance toward the darkened structure. "It doesn't look open."
"Closes at 6 o'clock, he replied. "You'll have to wait outside."
I looked out of the bus into the darkness beyond. The temperature was already hovering somewhere in the 30s, with snowfall forecasted for later that evening.
"But they didn't say," I began.
"There isn't anything I can do, miss,"
he cut in.
"I have another pickup scheduled and I can't wait around."
The other passengers had already disembarked, and he pointed toward the steps, indicating that I should do the same. I nodded, dulled by the realization.
"Be safe,"
he called, the doors closing behind me. Afterward, I stood in front of the closed station, holding my suitcase between my hands, hesitant to set it down onto the damp, snowy ground. A single streetlight illuminated the area in which I stood, so that while my own person was aglow, only a few steps away there was nothing, only blackness. I struggled to remain calm, my breath erupting before me in great billowy clouds, the dampness clinging to the scarf knotted around my throat.
"Hey, you!"
a voice called out. I peered into the darkness, uncertain whether the deep voice had been aimed in my direction. I could see nothing except the snow on the streets, sparkling, or so it seemed, under the light.
"Yeah, you!"
the voice came again. A figure stepped into my small circle of light. He was young, surely no more than a few years older than myself, his tall, athletic build tightly bundled in a military green jacket, with worn leather patches at the elbows. A single suitcase dangled from his hand.
"Do you need a lift?"
"I'm waiting for a bus," I answered. When he looked around as if to indicate his doubt that such a thing existed, I hastened to explain. "It's not due for another 2 hours." He frowned.
"I think the station is closed for the day."
"But the bus driver said..." I let the words die on my lips. I looked around at my surroundings, looked at the boy in front of me. He glanced over his shoulder.
"A few of us are splitting a cab back to Williams College."
I squinted through the darkness, but if there were any others, I couldn't see them. "I'm trying to get to Bennington," I replied. "I go to the college there."
"Bennington?"
he asked, a grin spreading across his features.
"I've heard some interesting stories about the girls there."
I frowned, wondering whether I should be offended or not.
"I'm just teasing,"
he said hastily, as if he had read my thoughts.
"And besides,"
he grinned,
"I sort of go there myself."
"What do you mean?" I frowned. "It's an all-girls school." My voice was sharp, guarded. I wondered whether he was laughing at me or something else.
"I know,"
he laughed.
"So, as you can see, I don't really fit in, which is why I do most of my coursework at Williams College. But I'm actually part of the theater project at the school, at Bennington, I mean."
"Oh," I responded, taken aback by the response. I was aware, as were most of the girls at Bennington, of the strange loophole that allowed local boys to attend the college, at least on a part-time basis. The school had made the decision back in the 1930s, after realizing the need for a male population in order to widen the scope of stage productions they were able to produce. It was a source of endless gossip for those girls who took part in the college's theater department, a chance to fraternize with the enemy, as it were. But the world of theater was one that rarely touched upon my own, and though I was now into my third year at Bennington, this was the first boy I had met who actually took part in the program.
"You know, I think I've seen you before,"
he said then, with that same grin. I shook my head, embarrassed at the idea that someone might have been watching me. "I don't think so." He nodded.
"Yeah, you and this other girl. You're always together."
I paused. "Lucy." He smiled.
"It's nice to meet you, Lucy."
I blushed, realizing the mistake, his mistake or mine, I wasn't sure, and I hastened to explain. "No, sorry, that isn't my name. What I meant was that it must have been my roommate, Lucy, that you saw me with."
"Oh."
He nodded, sounding disappointed by this piece of information. He shrugged and said,
"Look, why don't you come along with us? You can't stay out here on your own, not in this weather,"
he said, though his face seemed to indicate that it was the late hour rather than the temperature that unsettled him.
"I have a car back on campus. I could give you a lift to Bennington."
I hesitated a moment, maybe longer, before considering the hour and the darkness and that steady feeling of fear that had slowly begun to encroach upon me before he had appeared, my savior, or so it seemed. And so I followed him, out of my circle of light, of safety, I could not help but think, wondering what it was that I had traded in the process, one unknown for the other. But then, Only several feet away stood the promised group of friends, huddled around a taxi. Packing in together, our bodies pressed tightly against one another, with one of the girls forced to sit on the lap of one of the boys. I listened as they laughed and joked with one another, this group of friends that I had been so hesitant to join at first. There was Sally, an art history major at a college in New York, who was planning to spend the summer in Venice, and Andrew, who wanted to follow his father's footsteps and become an English professor. There was another girl whose name I couldn't remember, but who was all smiles and laughter, mainly aimed in Andrew's direction. And then there was the boy I had met first, and whose name was Thomas, Tom for short, and who was the most reserved now in his circle of friends, though he smiled and listened to them as they spoke. I felt a sudden ache as we pulled away from the station, watching the friendship that existed among those in the group, evident in the easy, casual way they had with one another. It was so different from my own strange little twosome that I had formed with Lucy, and which all at once seemed odd and lonely in comparison. I had found our closeness thrilling at first, but as the years had begun to pass, I had come to feel that for everything I told Lucy, she somehow managed to absorb the information without ever giving back any of her own. Initially, I had put it down to shyness, convinced that she, like myself, was simply unused to living so closely with another person. Confidences would come eventually, I told myself in the beginning. I would only have to be patient. But then it was the holidays and we were off for home, and then back again, and away once more for the summer, and still I had learned so little about the girl who was closer to me than anyone else I had ever known, who knew all my secrets, each and every little one. But then, no, I corrected myself. Girl wasn't the right word. Lucy was a woman. She dressed like one, acted like one, she even walked like one. Secretly, I had always believed it was down to the loss of one's virginity, as if the act of copulation would somehow bestow upon one a sudden sense of maturity, as if that one act had the power to dispel the insecurities and worries that plagued most girls from the start of puberty. It was nonsense, of course. I was convinced that Lucy had never so much as kissed another human being, and yet she dressed, acted like, and walked the way I wanted to, with confidence, with control, as if she were entirely certain of who she was. Covet. It was a peculiar word, one I tended to associate with long, dull lectures on Hawthorne and other early American writers from the Puritan age. I had to look it up once as part of an essay I had been forced to write in school. What I found was, to desire wrongfully, inordinately, or without due regard for the rights of others. There were other definitions, more words, different words, although all of them meant the same thing. But it was that first part that had stayed with me. To desire wrongfully. It struck me as strangely beautiful, and yet frighteningly accurate. The feelings I felt toward Lucy, I often thought, were something like this, something sharper than a normal friendship, something that I felt threatened to overwhelm, and quite possibly destroy. There were moments when I had thought that I did not so much as want her, as I wanted to be her. The two feelings were so strong and so opposite, yet they continued to merge and mingle until I was no longer able to tell one from the other. I coveted the easy way she had, and I desired that, her way of being. I wanted it for my own. And there were days when I almost felt it, when, emboldened by her nonchalance at the world that already, even in my young years, seemed so cruel, I was able to withstand the shadows, the anxiety that so often plagued me. And so there were days when I never wanted to part from her, when I felt that my whole being depended upon my close connection with her. And there were days when I hated her, resenting myself, resenting her, for this self-reliance, this symbiotic relationship that we had formed. Though on the darkest days I wondered whether it really was, whether there was anything that I had to offer her, and whether what she offered me wasn't more a crutch than a benefit. Lately I had struggled more with the strangeness of our relationship, as I was never able to explain it fully, not even to myself. and sitting in the back of that taxi, surrounded by this easy, carefree group of friends, I was struck once more by the need to be able to understand it all before it threatened to overwhelm me, totally and completely.